Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Today's video is brought to you by Predictable Revenue's service LinkedIn Outbound. Find out how we can leverage and grow your existing LinkedIn network to book meetings into your calendar at the link below. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by Michelle Feaster. She's the co-founder and CEO over at Usermind, and we are going to have a different conversation than we normally do. I think one of the best parts of this podcast is the fact that we get to dig in with frontline sales leaders and talk tactics. And I think there's been one recurring theme, and if you've listened for a while, you've probably heard me harp on this quite a bit, and that it's that the belief and my feeling, and there's lots of research that back it up, that says a lot of companies jump to try and scale before they have product market fit. And that's where a huge amount of time, resources, and just human life, not human life, but human hours is wasted. Life is maybe a bit too extreme of a way of framing that up. But one of the things I'm really excited about is Michelle has not only been part of some pretty impressive organizations in the past, but she's also got sort of a methodology for how to create a category, which is sort of even bigger than product market fit. So Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm looking forward to this for my own personal growth and to get a chance to learn from you. Maybe just so we can get clear on definitions for everybody that's listening, what is a category and why should I care if my company is a category creator or a commodity?
Yeah. So a category, I mean, the ultimate expression of a category is that some analyst, right, Forrester or Gartner, that moves the market, creates a new wave or a new magic quadrant, tracking or following you. That would be, I mean, the goal of category creation. I think, that can take, that path can happen a couple ways. One, you can just find a completely net new problem, right, and a completely net new needed solution. And that, that's kind of the path Usermind has gone down. But in some cases, you're basically reframing an existing problem that's become more strategic. And so I think there are two kind of different paths to achieve that objective. And from my mind, why is it so strategic? There's a lot of, different things people value. I value the opportunity to reset the price point in the buyer's mind. So the beauty of a category is it is a new problem and a new solution you've defined to that problem. And ideally, when you do that, you define a very high value problem and you create a giant TAM for yourself. And so a software company, that's kind of I've spent 20 years in enterprise software, a software company creating a category is looking to try to build a material public independent software company because there's enough buyers who need that net new thing and it's valued and the price point is such that you can build kind of an independent software company. And so a category is a pretty big definition, but I think, at least from my point of view, it's one path to building a very independent, very large software company is to basically find a net new pain, be the market leader, and then build a company around your success there. I don't know if that dovetails with how you think about it, but.
For sure. And I think it's, you can sort of look at like product market fit and that's sort of the zoomed in version of like the more tactical edition, of this, but it's, are you creating a new product? And then what you're saying is, well, I don't want to just create new products. I want to create an entire new market. I want to create an entire new category where there are no comparables. So if I'm sitting here talking about how to create a new tool to send emails and make phone calls and sort of engage with prospects, you might be able to find product market fit there, but there are already competition there. What you're saying is don't worry about that. Let's go find something brand new so that we don't have to compete against those other clowns that have already built these businesses. And you can just focus on something net new where you can set the price. You can set the sort of, terms, the playing field of where we operate.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely. And in some cases, that may be a completely net new category, right? That's the journey I've been on for 7 years. But I'll tell you, in one of my previous career chapters, this is kind of led to the acquisition of Opsware. We were basically taking five different markets and reframing them into a single, or five different technologies and reframing them into an integrated solution. And so we were kind of shifting the market's desire from buying server automation or network automation to buying end-to-end data center and application automation. And so, you know, in some cases, it's a totally net new greenfield market. And in some cases, you have a strategic or a market innovation or perception that shifts the way the buyer looks at it. And that can be another path. Both of which are obviously hugely valuable, and you do them to win.
Interesting. And so when you're looking at these, like, how do you even go about identifying and saying, hey, I found a category? I don't imagine you're flipping through a magazine of like Category Weekly and you're like, oh, this one looks new. I'll jump in here.
Yeah. I mean, I have a pretty simple rule of thumb. So whether it's true or not, it could be debated. But my observation is that, you know, when you have a single change happening to your buyer, you know, for example, virtualization is happening. You might be able to build a company that I call it a tuck-in. You could probably build $100 to $200 million company on some problem that shift creates. But what I look for in categories is that there are three or more big shifts hitting the same persona, the same person that you're building software for. And so if I go back to kind of the early days of UserMind, kind of the first big shift was that the business was buying a ton of software. The second big shift is that SaaS software all had APIs. And the third big shift is that there was a new operations team being formed to manage all that tech. And I thought, wow, this persona is in the middle of so much change. I'm going to go interview a bunch of those people and I'm going to find a big problem. And so to me, it's the rule of disruptions. One thing changing, probably not enough. But if you get enough change on the same buyer, you really have a giant opportunity to create a new category or to find a category potentially.
And so in terms of like getting into the practical how, it sounds like the first step is you're having conversations with people. I'm guessing, so I guess, what do those conversations look like? And then I'd love to get into like, how do you measure for and quantify the opportunity?
Yeah, so I think I'm a big believer in what I call day in the life interviews, which is interviews that do not lead the witness down a path of some assumption you have, but really factually try to gather information about their day. So when I was thinking about interviewing these marketing ops folks or this, you know, sales operations teams or HR operations teams, I literally sat down and made a list of 20 questions in a Word doc. And they were basic questions. They were things like, you know, when you walk in the morning, what is the first thing you do every day? How many applications do you log in a given day? Which applications do you love and why? If there was a problem I could solve for you, what would it be and why? Who do you report to? What are your MBOs? And so what I was really looking to understand is what did this person do all day? And what did they love? And what did they perceive as pain? What were they promoted if they did well, you know, and what were their challenges in their interaction with their boss? And so I was kind of capturing some total picture of like, this is their technology landscape that they're operating in. This is their kind of daily work life. And this is what they're responsible for in the company. And so to me, that was, you know, that's kind of the basics of just collecting the facts. And I probably did that about 300 times across, you know, pretty much anyone in operations in the business side who would meet with me and have a glass of beer or a glass of wine pre-COVID, of course, you know, now it would be a Zoom meeting. And then I literally just would sit down in tranches and look for patterns. And what I was looking for, what a product person you're looking for, is patterns of pain, patterns of problems, and ideally problems that have a value attached to them if you solve them. And so to me, you know, making sure you do every interview the same way, making sure that you're kind of collecting all the same relevant data, and then ideally, obviously, getting to a statistically significant number of those meetings to start to see patterns emerge and unfold. So that's to me the how you validate. And I think you could do a flavor of that pretty much in any market or business, and you'll come out of that understanding 1, 2, 3 pain points that persona has that you might be able to, you know, to build software around. And by the way, in the example of UserMind, what I heard over and over again was, I walk in every day and I have 6 or 7 different systems. You know, I have my MarTech stack, my CRM stack, my help desk stack, my web analytics stack. That data doesn't connect together. And so you'd have this really critical customer journey, like customer onboarding, and it didn't really have a home. There was no way to know where people were. And I thought, well, man, that seems kind of crazy that these mission critical customer journeys don't live anywhere. They're not easy to analyze or optimize. And so that's kind of the problem I focused on that came out of that validation. You know, when you think about the business value, there's kind of a whole, to me, like a whole series of steps that I went through. So one question was, when I thought about this problem, as an example, onboarding, if you can improve customer onboarding, what's the outcome? And to me, the outcome is you can drive lifetime value, right? Or you can minimize churn. And I like that kind of problem. So I have anytime you can find a technology problem, right, a gap that I could build software to solve, ideally what you're looking for is what's the ROI, like what's the business impact to the, you know, buyer of actually implementing the technology. And in the case of the user mind, you know, discussions that I did, to me, it seemed like it was a giant ROI. Like what's the impact to a SaaS company if you can decrease churn by 2%? That can be in the millions, tens of millions of dollars. And of course, in my head, I thought, well, gosh, what if I could do that for General Electric or US Bank or, you know, these giant global brands, you know, what would be the impact? And I thought, well, that could be hundreds of millions of dollars. So when I think about business value, I think about it in three ways. So what is the value to the buyer? Like what's the pain you solve for them? And your product, actually, to get product market fit, the product that you design actually has to solve that daily pain. But I think the size of the market opportunity is much more measured by the business value conversation. So you have to like deliver technical value to the buyer and solve their problem. But the business value is the outcome to the company. And so I kind of took that in two steps, maybe three steps. One was just like for each customer I talked to, if I did back of the napkin, what's the ROI of solving this workflow problem they talked to me about? Optimizing trials or optimizing onboarding or, you know, optimizing cross-sell. And in every case, I was talking about seven-figure value. And that's the first thing to me is like, okay, check. And why is that interesting? It means that your TAM is big. Your total addressable market's going to be big. If the value for, you know, one small customer is going to be in the seven figures, then you probably have billions and billions in TAM. And I'm sure you've had many people on the podcast who've raised money, but we all know that if you're going to take VC money, you need to find a big enough market that they're willing to invest in it. And so my first question was, you know, what's the ROI of solving this specific problem that they gave me? And, you know, it's okay if it's a swag. And then I said, okay, well, let me try to size the market. And I did what's called a bottoms up TAM in, you know, product marketing, which is you take the segments of the market, you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 500, Global 2000, SMB. And I said, how much do I think they'll pay me for this? And it's never the value, right? It's 10% of the value. I was pretty conservative. And then you kind of add that TAM up. And I was like, wow, for UserMind, that TAM is $5 to $7 billion. I can probably, like, there's a real public company. Even if I got 10% of that market, I'm talking about $500 million software company. If I got 20% of that market, I'm talking about $1 billion software company. And so I thought, well, that's worth spending 14 years of my life or whatever, 10 years of my life trying to build that thing. And then the last thing I did was just a tops down TAM, which is like, hey, you know, if I could redirect 0.5% of IT spend or cloud spend toward this problem, what does that come out to be? And so that was more like a $10 billion TAM. And I said, gosh, the problem is very replicable. Like everyone I'm interviewing has the same problem. So it's very broadly applicable. It's high value. It'll lead to a high ACV. Therefore, the TAM is big, both bottoms up and top down. And that was when I said, okay, like this is a big problem, right? It's not a tiny, you know, build a $10 million software company problem. Could be a category in both size and pressure on the buyer.
I love how you're starting with the sort of total addressable market and trying to figure out, is this, you know, I see a problem here. Is the juice going to be worth the squeeze, right? Like you're going to put a significant amount of time in your life. And obviously like the product market fit first, heavily influenced from, I'm guessing, you know, some of the guys at Opsware. Have written quite a bit on it. I'm curious the sort of steps to go from, you know, I think there's a category here. I've got my 2-3 insights. I've got my TAM to know like, okay, this might be a category, but what does it actually look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, I think the next step is you have to try to break down what is the product that you're going to build? And a central question of a category is it defensible, right? Is the solution itself different enough from the current way people are approaching this that you can, there's like mental space for a new Kleenex, right? I always say that, you know, ultimately a category, the category king becomes Kleenex. It's like, we don't use tissue, we use Kleenex. And so the goal of a category is to give you the opportunity to be the Kleenex of that category. And a lot of that, you know, one, if you've checked the box on like disruption, you've checked the box on TAM, then the next question becomes, is the solution different enough from the existing approaches? Like, what are the existing ways people solve this problem? And is my solution going to be different enough that I can actually go to people and articulate why it's really different? Does that make sense? And so, you know, I sat down with my co-founder and we basically, you know, took these like giant writing tablets. I felt like a little kid in, you know, in like drawing class, you know, from when you're, you know, 8 or 9. And we tried to whiteboard out, what do we think, what's the technology we build to solve this problem? And so for UserMind, that really boiled down into kind of 3 core capabilities. One, we needed to build integration software that would connect these various systems together. 2, we needed an event-driven workflow engine, because I just thought it was really silly that people had to like log into these systems to check the data. The future is going to be like smart software, right? Where software itself basically does a lot of this manual work without needing human intervention. And then the third thing was, I heard a lot about like experimentation, that these workflows, these journeys didn't really, they weren't waterfall, right? That people were really thinking about optimizing them on an ongoing basis because the ROI was so big. So you need some kind of A/B testing or analytics and optimization platform. And so I thought, okay, that's a very interesting differentiated stack. I went out to the market and said, okay, do I see anybody who's built this vertically integrated stack anywhere? I see a lot of integration companies, right? This is before MuleSoft exited, but you know, there's a whole landscape of integration companies, everything from MuleSoft to Zapier. Cool. I see workflow automation. I see marketing automation and I see help desks. I see plenty of like standalone, what I would call old school workflow, which is very static. I didn't see anybody really having innovated what I call event-driven workflow, which is kind of modern, reactive, intelligent workflows. And then I saw a lot of A/B testing. In fact, it was pretty clear that A/B testing was becoming a really dominant approach to kind of driving growth. But for the most part, it was in a single channel. It wasn't really a cross-channel or at a workflow level. And so I thought, man, that's very differentiated, right? Like I don't see anybody else with the exact tech stack solving this problem. So it's probably different enough that we can go make a compelling argument, right? Why this is different from the landscape, because you got to carve out your own category. And then the last thing that I really liked about it, and this might be personal, is just integration's really hard. Like very, very few companies have been able to cross the chasm and successfully build an integration, the number of integrations needed, the integration ecosystem, the brand, the trust. And to be honest, what that said to me is this is very defensible. If we could pull it off and really build this platform, then we're probably going to have a moat, right? We're going to have a bunch of defensibility in our architecture that even if someone comes along later and kind of pivots into our space and copies the language, it's very hard to copy the architecture. And so that's always a goal for me, is not just to have a unique technology offering that doesn't exist, but ideally one that if you make some hard bets up front, it'll pay off in being very, very defensible long-term. And so that was kind of how we thought that part of it through. If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I follow you. And so if I kind of reframe, you're sort of doing these interviews so you can identify that, you know, like what is that core disruption, mm-hmm. That needs to happen. Then you're doing some mathematical exercises to sort of quantify what is the TAM, like, is this a big enough opportunity? The next thought is like, is this different enough? Mm-hmm. And then is this defendable, right? Is there an opportunity for us to get ahead? And it's not going to be just, you know, everybody can do this. Like Netflix had some defensibility because they had all these content providers sort of locked in. They also had all the data. So now they're creating their own. It'd be very difficult for you and I to go off and say, let's start up Netflix too. Like that's just not going to happen for me. It could happen for Disney because they have all that content sitting in the closet already, right. But not for you and me. And so the piece I'm curious about is the different enough. Like how do you quantify that? How do you decide what is different enough? Do we just like take Apple and change the color, or is there some sort of math that can go into this?
That's a good question. I think, so I would say a couple things about that. One, part of it's time horizon. So, and this, I got this a little bit wrong. Like, I think we were a little early at UserMind. It seemed very obvious to me that this was going to be a discipline. And I think we were probably a couple of years too early. But one way to make sure that you can understand different enough is kind of, you know, is anyone out there even close to doing it? And part of why I say this is, like, if you have enough time to really bake your platform differences and make them work, then you can probably bring to bear a different enough platform. Does that make sense? Whereas if literally you launch and 6 months later, seven other people are in your space, it's often hard enough. It's hard to pay that platform vision down because you basically are already in a knife fight in the market. So I think the benefits of being a little bit early is that oftentimes you can basically hit the market and, like, emerge from stealth and time the market with a platform that's very, very baked. I would say, by the way, Tanium is a great example of a company that did that for people who know enterprise software. That was the Big Fix guys, their second startup that they founded. So being early can be very good at being different enough. And then I think the other piece about enterprise software that I love is, part of different enough is the platform, the technology, and part of it's the positioning. So if you look at UserMind, you know, I think we have a very differentiated platform. And, you know, this year we got leadership in the way, in the Forrester Wave for the first time, and we got best platform or best existing product with, like, fives across the board. You know, that's 7 years of platform vision that culminate in that one assessment, right, by an analyst. But, you know, I also think positioning matters. You know, in the enterprise, it's not just the technology, it's also your narrative. And by the way, I would say David Cantle is an amazing example of this for people who are following Drift. He didn't just innovate a chatbot. If I described it as just a chatbot, that would be kind of, like, boring or you know, minimizing, right? But he combined this very innovative way to bring humans into what was a purely digital process, and he innovated around the narrative of conversational marketing. And I think in the enterprise, the best breakout, the most differentiated companies don't just have a differentiated technology, they have a differentiated narrative. And I wouldn't say that, you know, we've been the best at this at UserMind. I think we're finally figuring out how to tell our story in a very different way. But that, to me, defensibility and different is, how different is the platform and how hard is it to copy? And can you really quantify that? Can you think about that? And by the way, can you be in stealth long enough to, like, hide your ideas, right? Can you keep your IP secret? And then the other piece of it is, can you set the landscape? Can you define a narrative that forces them to kind of sell on your terms? And I think, to me, the breakout software companies have some combo of both, and they're differentiated at both levels. Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that you're framing that up with the narrative, because you're totally right about Drift. If you looked, like, I remember when I saw them launch and I was like, Intercom owns this space. Why even bother? Mm-hmm. And then you see and I think really what it was that set it apart for me was the conversational marketing is that narrative that they used. Mm-hmm. I think, and the podcast, I was a big fan of their podcast, though. Yeah. Maybe I'm just a sucker for a good podcast.
I think it's an amazing job, right? Talk about a great example of creating a totally new category around, or, you know, you could look at HubSpot, right? David came from HubSpot, or period of time he was at HubSpot. They acquired his company. And of course they differentiated as inbound marketing. And so you just look at it, or Salesforce, right? Differentiated with no software. And so I just think time and time and time again, there's some really unique technology. Like, look at Salesforce, the innovation to deliver via the cloud is pretty profound. But you know, the fact that they were able to kind of explain it to the world with this no marketing narrative, I think, no software narrative. That's the breakout, because then the technology itself is very, very different, but like, we as buyers can digest why it matters. And the narrative is like, why do I care about this? Why is this important? So pretty fascinating.
Love it. If you're in sales and you're listening to this podcast, have you figured out why I wanted to have Michelle on the show yet? Is it obvious? I'm coming back to sort of the disruption, TAM, different off, defensibility, timing element. You mentioned that you got timing wrong. And I know we originally planned to talk about this a little bit later, but I think that's a really interesting sort of time, because you mentioned you got the timing wrong at UserMind. So can you talk to me about why you think you got the timing wrong and the impact that might have had?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I would say two things about that. One, you know, when I did a lot of my interviews, I was interviewing people who managed more cloud than legacy. So a lot of my early interviews were people in technology companies, right? No mystery. My network has, you know, been in enterprise software and broadly in technology for 20 years. And so probably my sample size was a little too constrained. I should have interviewed more people who were in marketing operations, for example, in, you know, less exciting, like CPG companies, or, you know, think about, you know, even Nike, which is an amazing digital company, but has a lot more legacy technology. So one, I think I biased my sample size a little bit too much to the early adopters, the people who are like all cloud. And I did that, by the way, this is, you know, I spent 20 years building tech for IT. So it's kind of strange to hear me sitting here talking about, you know, building a customer engagement platform. And, you know, we're super focused on basically a retention marketing and lifetime value engagement. We think that, you know, most marketing companies are basically focused on acquisition and that's it. And I think, by the way, the fact that I hadn't done it before, I think my sample was a little too narrow. It was a little too tech-centric. And so I interviewed a ton of people who founded MarTech companies and said, what's your first vertical? And they all said tech companies. They all said, the enterprise won't pay attention to you until you get, you know, Slack and SurveyMonkey and Zendesk and these tech companies. And when you do that, you know, you can cross the chasm. And that's what Marketo did. And that's what ExactTarget did. And so that was kind of the playbook I was trying to follow, because I didn't really have first, you know, person experience with that category. And I think it was a little bit of a red herring, because when I actually publicly launched the company, turns out my pipeline went 100% enterprise. And very interesting, I mean, sounds, hindsight's always 20/20, but the problem UserMind solves is actually 10x more valuable for big companies than it is for little companies. You know, you go to Optimizely or you go to Slack and they can hire more salespeople and grow. You know, you go to a big enterprise company like, you know, a healthcare group, or you go to, you know, a big bank, and they don't have that luxury. And so I think, you know, I got my first segment wrong by kind of the way I set up my interviews. And because of that, I think I thought we were closer to this being like a must-have than it actually was. Probably 2 years earlier than I needed to have been if I had maybe set up my sample size a little bit better. But you know, Ben Horowitz is on my board and he likes to tell me, you know, you don't know what you didn't know. And so, you know, I guess the flip side to that is 7 years in, I've found a category. There's a Forrester wave, which is like the dream of all people chasing categories. We've been ranked as having the top product in that space. And what makes me most delighted is every single one of our competitors pivoted in from another space. We're the only purpose-built platform in our space. So, you know, I was early, and definitely it's taken longer to see it come to fruition than I would have expected, but I guess I could have gotten it more wrong, right? I could have been completely wrong about the market or wrong about the category. There are worse things than being early. But look, it for sure means that it takes time to get to that growth stage, right? Because you think when you get to product market fit, you're ready for hyper growth. And by the way, that's some combination of the product being ready and some combination of the market being ready for the idea to cross the chasm. And I don't think I was too early on the product side. I think I was too early on the market side, right? People really being ready to think about journeys, to optimize the ROI end to end, to be thinking about lifecycle marketing. That's what I was ahead of, not so much the product side.
And so I know we've talked about like quantifying things, but I want to ask kind of a soft and fuzzy question. Sure. You know, what did it feel like just as running the business when you had, like when you were early versus when you realized, hey, things are clicking? Was there like, did it feel like things are just flowing a little bit easier? You're not pushing a big rock up a hill anymore? Or was there any difference at all?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think, I'm sure every founder's experience is subjective, and you know, mine is probably just a data point of one, but I remember, so it took us a couple years. We kind of were in stealth building the technology and getting some alpha and beta customers. And then we launched the company. And I remember there was like this 6 month period where everybody we pitched to loved it, but nobody wanted to buy it. And that was kind of this tremendously stressful period where that's when we were realizing our segment was wrong. Like, you know, the mid-market didn't need our technology, and they loved the idea, but they didn't need it. And so there was this kind of pivot into the enterprise as we started to sell these big companies, and, you know, a bit of terror, like, wow, I kind of built the wrong product. I missed my segment. And then there was a period in selling to those enterprises where I would tell you, you could have, let's just say, I'll be generous to myself, 50 conversations and one person got it. And so for the first, you know, your early enterprise sales, you've probably seen this, you're selling to visionaries. Like, there's no broad market. You know, you can't go to people and say, hey, you know, have you thought about orchestrating journeys? People are like, I don't know what a journey is. But yet you bring it to a visionary. You know, I pitched the CIO of Schneider Electric. It was a 15-minute demo and the guy got it. And that became my first enterprise customer. And so the whole, you know, Jeffrey Moore crossing the chasm thing is super right. That like the early days are basically wandering in the wilderness, finding these visionaries. And it's really hard because you get more no's than yeses and you kind of got to hold on to like the fact that you're probably right. And I will tell you, in the last 18 months in my company, or even last year, all of a sudden people are like, yes, we know what journeys are. And we've been budgeting for orchestration technologies and we want to connect our channels together. And so I do think that there is, and we're probably not at like the tornado phase where every single company we go to is, we're probably still, you know, early majority. You know, maybe we're just starting to cross that chasm, but it feels really different. And to me, it's been most manifest by the way the language people use, their receptivity to our technology. And frankly, a lot of that's been driven by Forrester, right? Going out there and saying, this is a new type of technology, people going to their conferences. Because, you know, we're definitely, I don't have David's podcast, you know, we're definitely not, we haven't made quite the splash he's been able to make about conversational marketing with our story, which we call it experience orchestration. Like, customers come to you wanting to activate a phone or wanting to move and set up a new cable plan for their new house. They don't think about their engagement with you as being like web or SMS or in-app. They're like trying to set up, you know, the new cable subscription. And these are journeys. And so, you know, our theory is that basically businesses who orient and optimize for journeys will have more loyal, more happy customers, and frankly, a healthier business. And there's a lot of financial metrics around that. But I'll tell you, I do think it's, you know, there's this quote, and it's from the guy who wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and Les Mis, whatever his name is. He wrote, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. And to me, that's product market fit, is when all the elements have come together and your buyer has been educated and they're primed to think about, in my case, orchestration as a capability, and they've thought about journeys and they're bought into that shift, and we're a leader, that's when you're in the vortex and the tornado. And I do think it feels really, really different today than it did even a year ago in terms of that context.
So I guess, would you say there are maybe degrees of product market fit? Like you've got sort of, you've got it a little bit versus you have it, or is it more binary?
I do think it's a bit of a gray area. You know, to me, when you have product market fit, you've kind of crossed the chasm and you're now selling to the early, you know, early majority and kind of not really the laggards, but you know, the middle of the market, because they've accepted that this is needed. And so I would say like, that's the tornado. But I do think it happens click by click, right? It's some adding up of like, the product works well enough to deliver value. You have enough customer references, the market's consolidating, or you know, an analyst is tracking you. And I think companies can get there. Like, you could do it all on product, or you could do it all in analyst, or you could do it all in narrative. But I think you probably really get to product market fit when you have enough of each of the legs of the stool really working. And probably the mix is different for every founder or every, you know, enterprise company that's going through that. But I'll tell you, it feels much better to be on this side than, you know, the wandering in the wilderness when you're like, you know, you think it's good, but, you know, everyone's excited but won't buy it. Or, you know, even, by the way, I think it's harder when you get these like occasional geniuses who buy your stuff and you're like, why doesn't anybody else get it? What's wrong? So I don't know about other founders, but I've definitely had these kind of 6 to 9 month, you know, windows in the company where it just changes. And now you're just in a different, I call it rings of a tree. You know, you're just in a different, you know, era of the company's history.
Totally. I felt this very similar way where you're looking for, we found for our, the first product, the first, my first stab at entrepreneurship was a salesperson said, I want to be an entrepreneur. So I built something in the sales space because I'd seen sort of a market opportunity. I feel like I had a couple of those things. I did not have the framework to put this together, but I remember finding that sort of that one individual, that one like, early evangelist who really got it. And then my problem was he was, I think, too far out. And I think one is he was too far out. And two, I think we hadn't framed up our problem correctly. So my experience is very similar, even though we come from, you know, very different backgrounds. And I remember that I'm alone in the desert and we finally found this oasis. And I'm like, okay, we've got something. Yeah. And then it turns out it was just an oasis. And there was either it was imaginary or, you know, the next one was a bit too far away. And so we've talked a little bit about the sort of different enough. And then there's the, and like, but I think I'd like to take it back just a step when we talked about the TAM and you were talking about how you were coming up with the sort of value of the market. And I understand that like, okay, if we're looking at, you know, top down, bottoms up, but I'm curious, how do you measure the sort of the business value that you're creating? And then how do you decide what, you know, what's an appropriate chunk for you to take?
Swag. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, it's a, this is, TAMs are hard. It's a little bit art. It's a little bit science. So, you know, when I looked at it, so my initial TAM, when I did my Series A raise is more conservative than it is now. Largely because I, you know, made some pretty conservative assumptions. So I told you when I did an interview, I would, you know, if I interviewed somebody as an example at Tableau, there's a lot of data about their business. And so I'd be like, okay, you know, if I'm going to optimize onboarding at Tableau, what do I think is the top line impact of that? And I would ask them, you know, I didn't just make stuff up. So I kind of validated per interview, think about it as the TAM of the individual client. You know, what's the, and really not TAM, what's the value that, that, you know, I would provide to them. And I was pretty conservative. I kind of assumed in the early days, and this is, by the way, one of my beliefs about pricing is that in the early days, you kind of get 1% of the value. And I'm making it extreme, but arbitrarily extreme. And as you have more references and you have more brand, you do value capture better. So if you look at most enterprise software companies, their prices go up over time and their ability to command price goes up over time. And it's a factor of leverage. And so I kind of assumed very conservative spend, like literally I assumed my mid-market people would spend 25K, which I thought, you know, man, if I'm going to solve a 500K problem, like somebody will write me a 25K check. And then, and by the way, a lot of my interviews were in mid-market. So I felt pretty confident that, that would be true. And by the way, that did bear out to be true. You know, if you looked at my mid-market customers, my smallest check was 5K and probably my biggest check was 100K, but it kind of averaged out. I didn't ever go back and do the math, but 25K was a good enough assumption. And then to be honest, I just did magnitudes. I said, you know, if I'm going to go to Fortune 2000, I bet you they'll spend, you know, 10 times that or, you know, five times that. And so I took some swags that were conservative. And you know, then just, it's just raw multiplication. And so I think, I didn't want to be too conservative, but you don't have all the data. And so you've kind of got to make some assumptions that pass a sniff test. And by the way, like really who are you convincing? It's yourself that it's big enough and that it's an investor to write a check around it. And so you don't have to have all the data, but you know, for me, I think it was credible in fundraising because all my SMB was backed by interviews and I had good value oriented data. And so they felt good about that. And to then it's like, okay, intellectually, does it, you know, do you think, you know, a company that's 10x that size would pay five times more? Yeah, that seems right. And by the way, in the early days, everybody knows you don't know. and then by the way, over time, obviously your approach to TAM changes because you're trying to figure out value capture. So if you look at my company today, right, we're definitely, we understand much better about A, what value we deliver and how to get, you know, a price point that makes sense. And so there's definitely a journey where the pricing and TAM will change over time. And hopefully I'm not just repeating myself at that point. I hit on the point you wanted to
Come
back to. Yeah,
totally. It was, yeah, we could probably spend a whole podcast talking about like how to quantify the value of a sale and, you know, especially from like a sales element. Mm-hmm. And then like, what is the right amount to capture there? It's interesting to see the sort of like the 1% number is how you started as a baseline and then it kind of ratchets up.
Yeah. And look, I think the key about the TAM is you don't have to be right. It's a swag. That's why I always do bottoms up and tops down. The point is just, is it big enough? And to some extent, if it's bigger than 4 billion, or, you know, if you're in consumer, it probably has to be in the trillions to be interesting. But, you know, that's really what you're trying to answer is like an order of magnitude, how big can this company be? And so I think I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs get very hung up on, is the 25K right? Is the 3X right? It's not important that it be right. It's important that it be directionally correct. I always use that answer. And so my question was like, directionally, do I think this is a $5 to $7 billion market? And like, even if, you know, one of my percentages was wrong, it's still close enough. Even if I was wrong by an order of, you know, I was like 50% off, it would still be a $3.5 billion TAM. So that was kind of like, to me, is just, am I in the ballpark to build an independent software company? Can I imagine myself building a $200 million, $300 million, $500 million software company? That's what TAM will tell you. And that's what it will tell an investor. And so I would just urge people not to over-rotate too much in getting it exact, because you can't know. At that stage of your company, you can't have all the answers.
That's totally fair. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if we kind of come back to the big questions that we're asking, where do competitors sit in this? You mentioned that, mm-hmm. you know, you've been able to create this sort of Forrester wave, mm-hmm. as they call it. And mm-hmm. there were a number of people that pivoted in.
Yeah.
And so obviously there were people that were in adjacent spaces before. Yeah. How does that factor into your thinking around like creating the category in the first place?
You know, I would say that, and this was a deliberate thought. So this is our third idea. So out of those interviews, there were actually two other ideas. The first one, by the way, was for salespeople. The second one was kind of a, you know, usage analytics type product. And in both cases, so in the sales app idea that I had, I just felt I wasn't the right founder. I'm not a consumer founder. I didn't really know how to do that. My second one, there were tons of people already doing it. Mixed panel, Kissmetrics, Segment. And I thought, well, gosh, we're going to be like the 105th technology in this space. So, you know, when I looked at and did, you know, competitive analysis, it was pretty clear that we were too late. That was not going to be the market we're going to go after, even though there was plenty of data suggesting that that technology was required or needed. And so, you know, when I looked at, you know, UserMind and orchestration, there wasn't really a clear platform player in the space. And so to me, that's still where I think we are. You think if you're right and the market starts to happen, everyone's going to pivot in. And what you hope is that your bets you made on platform pay off long term. And so far what we're seeing is as the market gets more educated, what we've bet on is becoming more valuable, which is why we got kind of top current product in the space. And that, I don't know how to tell people how to do that. That is, I mean, I've been doing product and enterprise for 20 years. But I think you have to have some bets as to like, what does the customer, what will they value the most? And where do I need to be really differentiated in a way that matters to them? And then where could I be just me too or good enough? And I'll give an example, like in our market, our bet on integrations has been very powerful. And the fact that we can go in and connect to kind of custom systems really fast, it just paid off over and over and over again in deals. And it's funny, A/B testing, we have it, our competitors have it. I've never seen that be the feature that like wins or loses a deal, which is kind of weird. It's actually quite a high value feature. But if you can't get the system connected into your legacy, or you can't get the system connected into your cloud apps, which change on a constant basis, kind of the rest of it doesn't matter. And so I think, we made kind of three architectural bets that seem to be paying off in the market. But, you know, you never know 100%. You kind of reacting to like the data you have, and then, you know, you kind of see how that plays out and make different bets over time.
Gotcha. It seems like you've taken all this information, all the research and everything to give yourself like a level of insight in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. you had something going in, but now you want to get inside the tornado and really understand and talk to people. And then you were able to distill down, you know, a couple of key you know, insights about this is where we think the market is going. And then the next piece was like, you know, trying to slot yourselves into somewhere unique. I'm curious, like, is there a spot that's where you got too small, or you said, hey, this is actually too niche, there too, the TAM is gonna, you know, be too small for this?
No, I mean, we've always been on the other end of that, where, you know, we had some debates in the company, and maybe we should have, where we were debating, should we pick just one journey and be awesome at it? So should we just be the customer onboarding company as opposed to the experience orchestration company? And there's no way to really answer the question of like, would we be more successful if we'd gone that path versus staying a platform? But we, you know, we pretty much kind of played the platform, you know, game, and have played the platform strategy. And I think, I mean, it's amazing in enterprise that 7 years in, platform is now beginning to pay off, that it's like really clear those are the right calls. You know, you don't know for a long, long time. That's where enterprise to me is both so awesome and so, you know, interesting, is like consumer ideas can blow up in 4 years and you had a billion-dollar company. You know, you look at MuleSoft, and it took 15 years really for that company to kind of become, and then of course it's like, it was always there and it's the dominant player. But, I think we did debate it, but you know, we felt like if we were right and the market were that big, we'd need a platform. And again, I could be persuaded that we should have picked a journey and, you know, been more kind of all in on a narrower solution on top of the platform. Maybe that would have helped us to accelerate, but, you know, it's hard to say at this point. You can't kind of, you just got to keep going forward.
Impossible to second guess yourself for something of that magnitude. Mm-hmm. It's one thing that like there, when we're, so if I put this into the sales context, or, you know, you look at, I think there's like product that connects to sort of the revenue organization, mm-hmm. and there's many different ways to slice. Like if we're running a campaign, if we get really super tactical, if I'm a sales development rep, right, I'm not just going to email the entire market. I'm going to niche down, and I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to go after, you know, this specific person at this type of company. In terms of like the way that you see things, you know, when you were originally looking at building the company, were you looking at this from, I'm going to create this like obviously we're talking category creation, but were you, I guess there's the lens of like the category, there's the lens of the user, there's the lens of the use case, there's a lens of like for companies. Yep. Is there a right or wrong one, or was it, you know, is a combination of all of them?
No, yeah. So we made a set of assumptions. So when we started the company, we said, we think we're building a platform and it's going to be a new category, and we didn't know what it would be called. So, you know, we just had faith. We said, we think sales and marketing have all the money. So instead of building, you know, HR workflows to start, we're going to start in sales and marketing because we think those are the highest value use cases. And we think those people are used to buying software. And we made the decision that our early segment, sorry guys, would be, hey Wyatt, would be mid-market. So we were going after kind of tech companies in the valley, basically. That was our subset. We got the platform right. We got the personas roughly right. We're still selling to kind of sales and marketing, although now that seems to be more often digital teams, right? Where there's kind of this new superstructure being formed. The journeys were, you know, acquisition, onboarding, cross-sell, upsell. So those have stayed the same. The thing we got most wrong was that segment. You know, I mentioned that, like, you know, the SMB was not the right fit. It turned out that it's actually... it's interesting. My best fit is like the largest companies in the world. But it's, you know, enterprise, kind of the classic, you know, Fortune 2000 type software company. So we did have a set of underpinning assumptions. And today, by the way, we are the platform. We call it experience orchestration. We focus today on 5 core verticals. So we, within the Fortune 2000, we focus on banking and healthcare, utilities, telco, and loyalty retailers. That's kind of our niche that we've picked. We think, and our hypothesis is that those are the verticals most being disrupted by startups. So basically, wherever startup money goes, think fintech, startups attack enterprises on customer experience. And so our hypothesis, the people who care most about optimizing customer journeys are the people who are most under threat if they do nothing. So we've kind of niched our go-to-market to be vertical specific. It's still Fortune 2000, and maybe the personas have morphed a little, as I said, from just being sales and marketing operations to now being more senior digital leaders or senior CX and journey owners. But you know, I feel like it's a Rubik's cube. You're like constantly turning the Rubik's cube until you get, you know, scale. So we're constantly asking ourselves, you know, is each of those assumptions correct? And which of these assumptions should change? And I'll tell you, just even in the last 6 months, healthcare has become more important with COVID. So we're seeing COVID dramatically accelerate healthcare providers' transformation in digital engagement. And so our hypothesis is we got to double down on that, especially given the fact that United Healthcare Group is one of our marquee customers. So hopefully that Rubik's Cube turning never really stops, right? And we're always kind of reassessing our assumptions and to improve the business performance.
Love it. And so you've been working on UserMind for 7-8 years now. I just love to, like, obviously, I imagine that's sort of evolved a little bit. Did you start with those, say, 5 verticals that we're going to go after? Or was it initially, it's one, we're going to focus on this one, and then we'll sort of land and expand from there?
No, I mean, it was all mid-market. So, you know, I totally whiffed on the verticals. I picked it absolutely. I mean, that was my, like, absolute wrong, you know, like, I don't know, Price is Right. You know, that was not the right choice. The market educated us, right? That's what happens. You get in market. It's like, oh, my pipeline has no mid-market companies in it. Sheesh, I didn't build the right product, did I? So, you know, we're definitely always iterating, and some aspects of the plan have, you know, been right. Like, I think our bet on the platform is right and has been paying off and is continuing to pay off. And then to your point, you know, like, completely wrong first segment. And, you know, we kind of had to learn, the market had to educate us, right? That, you know, that wasn't the right place to be. And in fact, our buyers were somewhere completely different. So I had no idea about banking or healthcare. By the way, I do think that's the risk. So, you know, they say that there's different kinds of founders, right? There's, you know, a lot of times founders are the inevitable founder because they have a lot of subject matter expertise. So, you know, I could have been a founder that came out of banking and really understood bank onboarding and was going to optimize that. And that'd be valid, but a different company. You know, I think because my background was kind of 20 years of building IT technology, and frankly, you know, living through orchestration in the data center, it just seemed so obvious to me that, like, orchestration capabilities were needed for the front office, for sales and marketing and HR. And so I think, like, that's part of why I think of the things that we were right about at UserMind, it was the platform strategy, because we're both my co-founder and I were, like, hardcore IT nerds and platform people. And probably we got some of the subject matter expertise wrong. Like, if I could go back to the beginning of the company, I would wish we had a third co-founder who would have been a former digital marketer or a former somebody who had done it, you know, in the trenches 20 times or 100 times. And could have brought a little bit of that SME to help us maybe land, you know, or translate what we believe was the problem into language that the buyer would understand better. I'd love to be able to go back and do that.
That sounds like it'd be really fun. I'm curious about, like, it sounds like there's some fun struggles, and obviously you learned quite a bit from it. Like, yeah. What did that look like from a practical standpoint when you say, hey, we're starting with the SMB market, and then it turns out, you know, mid-market is the real opportunity. Was your sales team involved in saying, hey, you know, we're not seeing customers? Or I guess, how did you look at it from somebody who's sort of designing the, not just the organization or the product, but the whole category?
Yeah, I mean, look, we built the product and we got a bunch of alpha and beta customers from our vertical. So we had companies like Xamarin and Slack, people working with us in the alpha and the beta, who were my hypothetical target market. And so we spent a couple years kind of in stealth building the platform to do the right thing. And we weren't geniuses. We finally came out of stealth and we launched a public website and we went to MarTech on the West Coast and did a press release and a bunch of press. And then we looked up and our pipeline started to be enterprise. And kind of that was in parallel with the fact that a lot of our follow-on meetings out of that MarTech show, for example, that were in the mid-market. So, like, when we were at that show, we were, like, really excited about all the tech companies who came and engaged with us. And, you know, but we also got enterprise interest. And we were like, why are these people coming to talk to us? And actually, we were totally wrong. So like all our excitement about those tech companies, those guys were interested but didn't have enough pain to buy. And then the enterprise was the opposite, is like they were skeptical, but they had so much pain if we could engage with them. And so I think there was probably, I don't know that I'm the fastest learner in the world. It took us some time to like really go out and do all those meetings and chase all those leads down and kind of look back in retrospect and just be like, man, you know, this is really our segment. This is where we're getting traction. This is where we're getting opportunities. And these guys like want to meet with us, but don't want to buy anything. So, you know, I often say that like friction, you know, interacting with reality is the best way to learn. And you know, if you were perfect, maybe you got it all right. And it just, you know, was a tornado, but a lot of times you got it partially right. And so you got to like go get in the real world and interact with people to learn. And so it took us probably 3 quarters to figure that out. And of course, as you might imagine, then you think about, well, what kind of sales team do I need? And what kind of sales leader do I need? And what kind of price point do I need? And so once you conclude that, there's actually quite a bit of work you have to do to kind of, you know, retool the organization and get the right people on board to go. Cause like selling to, you know, United Healthcare Group is totally different than selling to, you know, Optimizely. And so there was a lot of implications. It took us, you know, once we had a couple quarters of data as like a company out there in the market, it probably took us a year to like build the right product and figure out how to sell it. Cause everything's different, how you get leads and who you hire. And so it took us a while to kind of figure out what did the company need to be if we wanted to go sell these big accounts. So the highest of highs, the lowest of lows, the highest of highs, the lowest of lows.
Totally different motion. And yeah, I love the sort of comment on texture there, or like mm-hmm. going and experiencing reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me of favorite Jerry Seinfeld quote. It was from Comedians in Cars, and he's talking about, you know, just bombing on stage. And he said, pain is the sensation of experience entering the body.
Yep. Ben once said to me, Ben Horowitz, maximum discomfort equals maximum growth. Same. Yep.
I love it. I feel like I could just pick your brain on categories all day. One thing I'm curious about is, you know, there was a point where you joined Apptio, and I'm curious about how you, and this is obviously, so if you're on listening in, this is pre starting UserMind, and this is post being a part of HP and acquiring Opsware. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk to me about, you know, mm-hmm. the journey? And I think the learning, if you're listening, is, you know, how do I make the right decision? How do I make a good decision on a company to join based on, you know, on what we know?
Yeah. You know, this is a very important question. And I think stage of career matters. So first I'll give my answer for Apptio, and then I'll give my answer for people who are earlier in their career. But I ran product. So I was the VP of product. I was employee 17, and stayed with them through 600-700 people, and they've since IPO'd. So it was a tremendous success and great experience. So, and I think that's what we all want, right? When we're interviewing, we're trying to find the high growth SaaS startups where we can learn a ton and like grow our career and hopefully make money, and all those things align when there's growth. And so, but I mean, I was there before $1 million in revenue. So I was there relatively early, right? It was a Series A company. I guess they just closed their B when I joined. And the earlier you are, there's a lot of risk. So how do you assess it? So to me, the way I think about companies, and it's kind of similar to the way I think about markets, is it really boils down to 3 questions I would try to answer. The first question is the quality of the money. So, and the reason I point this out is we all talk about it, you know, it's Sequoia backed, it's Andreessen backed, it's Benchmark backed. The first question is how good is the money? And to me, that's just a proxy of like letting smarter minds than myself assess the market opportunity, assess the team. And so it doesn't mean that you can't join a startup that has, you know, money from like a tier 3 VC. But I think you should ask yourself how good, what's the quality of money that this leadership team and this product and this market, what have they attracted? And so I think it's helpful to understand that. And by the way, if in fact it's a, you know, not a tier, you know, we all know like the top 5, right? If it's not one of the top 5, why do those founders take that money? I would try to make sure I understood that answer. And what does that tell me? So that's the first thing I always look for. It's just like shortcuts to the credibility for me. And then the second thing you look for, and you know, Andreessen talked about this, is you need to assess the market and the team, right? So great markets can be achieved by bad teams. Great teams can't probably overcome a really bad market. But what you want, or what we all want to make money, is a, or to have a growth success or whatever we're looking for in our career, is we need a great team and a great market. And so those are like what I'm looking for is great money, great team, great market. And now, of course, how do you answer each of those things? I mean, I talked about great money. It seems pretty straightforward. It's like, is it a top 20 VC? If not, why? And are you satisfied with those answers? When I look at the market, I mean, to me, it's all about TAM and go to market. So have them, if they can't explain to you how big their market is and why it is, and it's the same framework I just walked everybody through, is like, who are they going after? How much will those people pay? Why will they pay it? And how many of those people are there out there? If you can't get a basic answer to that, you don't need to, and it's not a slide that says 5 billion. It's like the answer to those questions, and they probably don't know what their market is. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't join, but I would have a lot of reservations. And I will tell you, at Apptio, we didn't really know what the market was when I joined. I had a lot of confidence in the leadership team and in the investors. And so I felt like we could figure out the market, which we did. But does that hang together or does it not hang together? And then the team is, to me, just very self-evident. You know, how good, how, and when I say good, I'm looking at experience. So, you know, the CEO of Apptio is a serial founder. He had sold his last startup successfully. It was a small exit, but like he'd been there and done that. He knew how to raise money. He knew how to hire people. The head of sales who joined with me was a guy I worked with. He came out of Opsware and he was amazing. The co-founder was somebody who I was able to back channel, the CTO and co-founder, I could back channel quite successfully from, you know, a network in my life. And so I looked at it and thought, I think this is an A team. So when I looked at Apptio, I was like, okay, great investors. And, you know, Andreessen did the B, question mark on the market. I don't fully understand it. And like love the team. They all either have a lot of experience, and you know, Sonny was in it to try to build as big a company as he could. He'd already made some money. And so, you know, I thought, I think this team will figure out the market, and they have great investors who will help them figure out the market. And so that's really for me the equation. And it doesn't mean you have to have all three, but it means you have to have answers to all of those things. Why is this team going to be successful? What is this market and why could it be something big? And then what's the quality of the money? Why or why not did they get it? And I think as you peel that apart, you'll uncover kind of where the warts are and like where the opportunities are for you or for your skill set to either join or not join that company. So that's kind of how I thought about it. I don't know if that kind of call in maps to how you've thought about opportunities in your career.
Yeah, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking I would have much different experience had I had that framework from the get-go. It definitely maps. And when I look at things that went wrong or sideways, and I'm not saying, and honestly, I wouldn't trade any of that experience for anything because it provided the texture that got me here. Mm-hmm. But when I look at, if I had this framework, I would have made better decisions. And moving forward, I'm hoping that, you know, people that are listening will take this this framework and apply that when you're looking for that next opportunity. Because I've seen this across 1,000 companies that we've helped, that the number one thing that helps them be successful with us or be successful just in general is that product market fit. And like you said, it's great market, great team, ability to execute makes everything easy. It's the difference between, you know, pushing in a massive boulder uphill for the entirety of your journey at that company to, you know, actually it starts rolling downhill.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I'd say is I do think the answer can be a little different. You know, when I talk to people who are very early in their careers, either they're right out of college or, you know, I've been involved in a bunch of veterans transition programs or trying to help vets transition into tech. To me, that answer is different. It's like go to a big company and learn how to work from your peers. And I would just break that down to say, I often say to people, you know, I'll counsel people to say, go work at Amazon for 2 years, go work at maybe Azure, go work at, you know, some culture that's great, go work at Tanium, go work at, you know, I don't know who the best names are in the valley. I've been out of there for a long time. But you know, when you're in your first chapter of your career, the two things you're trying to figure out how to do is learning how to work. And to me, that's going and finding a killer culture with amazing people who are crushing it. And you're learning what success looks like. So people, you know, I always tell people, don't optimize for the title or the role. Get into a killer organization where the culture is amazing, where the bar is really high, because you're just learning how to work. That's all you're learning. But if you set that bar right, you're going to bring those skills with you everywhere else you go as you kind of like grow in your career and you, you know, have more opportunity. And then the other thing is, you want to associate yourself with great brands early in your career, because I don't know about anybody else, but if people ask me about my career, it's like, oh, Mercury Interactive, 10 years, you know, HP/Opsware is the brand, Aptio. You know, people don't read a resume. It's like, who are the brands you've been associated with? And that is, it doesn't mean that, you know, you can't, you have to only go to big brands, but it's such a big trust shortcut. And so that's another piece of advice I always give younger people is like, before you go to that startup, you know, go learn how to work and go work somewhere where, because that brand's on your resume, everyone's always going to give you an interview. Daisy, she agrees with that. So that's I think it's a little bit different when you're just starting out and when you're kind of like later in your career and you're evaluating multiple opportunities and you're like, how do I pick the one that really maximizes my next 4 years of my professional life?
Thank you so much. That makes a ton of sense. I know we've got a bit more time and I've got two questions here. And so I've got one that's totally not related, that I've been dying to get to personally. As somebody who's sits up here in Vancouver with, you know, minimal ties to the Valley, getting a chance to meet people that were involved in some of the books that I've read has been really cool. And I've had a few opportunities. And Michelle here is one of those. And so if you haven't read The Hard Thing About Hard Things, pause this episode, go listen to that book. And then the Opsware, Horowitz, Ben Horowitz and Andreessen it'll add some context here. But before we get to that, cause it's a bit of a detour, I want you to tell me a little bit about UserMind. Normally we put people through the ringer of making them cold call, but I just don't think it makes sense. Michelle, why don't you tell us a little bit about UserMind and how you help people?
I've never done it. I guess I've done many cold calls since starting UserMind, but I didn't know that they were cold calls. This is my first time ever selling software, so it's definitely been a learning opportunity. So UserMind. So we describe ourselves as the inventors of a market called experience orchestration. And I've talked a little bit about it, but here's the deal. Most companies' customers are struggling to interact with them and being frustrated by friction. So they, you know, are on the website and try to add a payee or check for pricing and they call the call center and the call center person has no idea what you and I have just been doing. Or, you know, we've been customers of a utility for 20 years and like, they have no idea about our usage. And every time we call in, they have no clue what like water heater to recommend to us or anything like that. So to me, this has kind of been the state of most big enterprise companies for the last 20 years. And it's the state of them in every vertical. You know, do we all love Comcast? Do we love our banking experiences? You know, any of these things. And so there's an emerging philosophy that says, in order to survive, big enterprises need to become customer centric. And when you and I come to them and we want to, I'll give my Comcast example, I'm buying a new house, I'm transitioning my subscription to my new house and I'm a huge boxing fan. And you know what I really want to do? Watch the fights. I want to have a house party and I want to watch the fights. And so, you know, for most companies that you would interact with, they're very channel centric. They're organized by channel. You know, I call and get pricing. The guy comes to my house and sets up my set top box. I go to watch the first fight. HBO's not been turned on. Now, that's how most companies work. They have different teams of people who own each one of those interactions. Those teams don't talk to each other. The tech doesn't connect. And as a result, I get to the day of my fight and I'm 20 minutes late because I had to call and try to get it turned on. All of us could tell that story 100 times over of different brands in any vertical. And so there's an emerging category called orchestration, journey orchestration, experience orchestration that says, rather than rip and replace all that tech, somebody should build a little conductor that sits on top of it, integrates into all that disparate tech, integrates into the call center app, integrates into the CRM, integrates into the web analytics from Google or Omniture, you know, integrates into email and text and all that stuff. and does three things: monitors the customer in journey, so knows who Michelle is and that she's, you know, in a account onboarding journey, and then either removes friction or drives personalization. And as a simple example, if UserMind was being used by Comcast, we could actually check the configuration of the set-top box in real time and know that that HBO wasn't turned on, and alert that that franchisee to like go fix that before he leaves. And so that's the concept, is like, how can you monitor and intervene in customer journeys in real time to kind of align the interests of the customer and company for the first time? The customer wants to have a great experience. They want it to be fast and quick and personalized, and we hate repeating ourselves. And if you're the enterprise, they want to deliver that. Like, what company wants to give all of us a crappy experience? But the tech gets in the way. And so that's really what we do. We essentially act like a conductor. We sit and make that a symphony and play the music and make the journey delightful, as opposed to kind of being frustrating and not really getting what you want out of it. And the cool part about it, kind of back to TAM, is that every journey that we optimize, whether it's for a bank or utility or telco, has an ROI to it that we can measure. We can actually measure, you know, do people, you know, deposit more money faster when they're setting up a checking account if we personalize the interaction? And the answer is yes. If you give people killer experiences, you can build a really profitable business, AKA Netflix, right? Is people love it. They're very loyal. They want to stay. And so that's kind of our brand promise. Our brand promise to the enterprises is, how can you deliver consumer grade experiences without having to rip and replace all your legacy technology? And the answer is, use an orchestration engine, use UserMind, and we'll kind of bridge the gap between all your disconnected teams and systems and these seamless experiences that you want to deliver. So that's kind of what we do. Maybe that was a little bit of a long-winded answer. Hopefully that was helpful.
It was great. It's not what I would use for my elevator pitch, but I think it explains it. It brought me from sort of not knowing anything to knowing quite a bit. And if I'm in sales and I'm listening to this podcast and I can't articulate the sort of my business that quickly, that eloquently, I'm probably going to listen to the last bit of this podcast a couple of times so that I can make sure I pull out that framework and I nail it. So thank you for coming on the show. If you want to hang up for the bonus question, just stay tuned. I guess we're not going to do anything. I'm just going to ask now, but I wanted to get that out of the way because this is a total left turn. And I actually have something I don't normally do, but I've got a couple people from Predictable Revenue that are hanging out, and Kenny's throwing me a chat here. So I'm going to ask my question because I'm selfish. Kenny, just type, and then I'm going to ask my question. And then if Michelle, if we have time, then we can get to yours. And Lavinia, if you've got a good one, start thinking about it, and then we'll save some time here. So I'm curious, because this is part of, you know, hard thing about hard things. One of the big sort of the culmination of, you know, all of Ben's work was or I shouldn't say all of Ben's work, but at least throughout it kind of focuses on opsware. Mm-hmm. And so a big punctuation mark in that journey is the sale to HP. Talk to me about your involvement there, and then how you built the case to buy that company.
Yeah. So I was at Mercury for 10 years. We get acquired by HP. I was running a big part of the testing business, so I wasn't even in the data center automation space. Boss calls me up and says, "Hey, there's this really broken business at HP, but it's really in focus because to date, opsware, by the way, the opsware market opportunity was largely driven by virtualization. The more complexity, the more you need automation, full stop. So like the more complex the data center got, the more people needed, they couldn't do it with humans, they need automation software. And so that's kind of what drove opsware's meteoric rise. So I said, okay, cool. That should be fun. By the way, I'm scared. That's usually a healthy indicator for me. So I'm going to go try to run that business. Now at the time, HP had made a couple acquisitions and we had a couple hundred engineers focused on this space. You guys probably don't know these names, but it was like Radia and AppIQ, and they had this product called Novadyne, a company called Novadyne they acquired. And basically, here's the deal. I took over the business. I'm looking at it over the first 2 weeks. And the answer is, we have 200 some odd engineers on these five products. And we're fifth in market share. So like, we're not succeeding. And here's the deal. Like, when the first three vendors in a space have 80% market share, you're not in an emerging market, you're in a consolidating market. And so if you looked at Opsware, Blade Logic, and IBM, those are the three top players, they had almost 85% market share. And so my like first QBR that I did, my feedback was, we missed this whole market. Like you can, and by the way, you're HP, you're not going to like innovate your way out of this one. We didn't build or buy the right thing. And there's really no path to go from like, 3% market share to 45% market share. So either we should buy the leader, if we either think this market is important enough to win that we have to own it, and so we need to do M&A, or we should just exit this market, right? It's like, put these engineers on something else where we actually can dominate the market. Because as we know, if you don't win the market, you don't make much money in software, right? You want to be like number one, number two, number three to make money. Everybody else doesn't make so much money. So that was like really quick math. It took me 2 weeks. I didn't even know what the products did. And so the question then is, okay, either we should, do we have to own it, or can we, can we shut this business down? And basically, if you talk to the field at the time, the answer was everything is only going to become more and more virtualized. And by the way, today, like you look, software-defined networking and software-defined storage, basically, and now containers, right? There's just been this endless explosion of complexity. In that world, automation continues to be a strategic market. And you can look at like now the value of Kubernetes as an example, just these crazy, valuations for people who can manage this stuff. So we said, we have to own it. We can't afford to miss this whole wave. Like, this is a critical wave that HP software needs to be in. So now we're going to go buy something. And for people who don't know the market, Opsware was number one, BladeLogic was number two. Opsware was a suite vendor. BladeLogic was basically a single product vendor, server automation. And so we said, look, we think the market wants a suite. So either we need to buy Opsware, or we need to do five acquisitions. BladeLogic, Opsware, Wyatt. Sorry, guys.
That's okay.
And so I will tell you, we thought BladeLogic had the better product and Opsware had the better suite. And the net of it is, we thought as HP, we couldn't pull off five acquisitions. So, that's kind of, if I was oversimplifying the journey, that's kind of how it happened. Along the way, obviously we built, a full, BD deck, and, obviously got engaged with both of those companies, and it boiled down to a single meeting in a room with myself and a bunch of other executives. And I actually cast the tie-breaking vote that we should go buy Opsware. And then we were in a sweaty room while they negotiated that deal. And of course, Ben joins HP and changes my life. So some of the basics of like, do you have to be in the market? Can you get from where you are without doing M&A? What are you buying? Are you buying the best product? Are you buying the best platform? And I always say to people, like, you have to know yourself. Like, HP couldn't have innovated its way there, and HP couldn't have acquired five companies. By the way, BMC bought BladeLogic, and they did four other acquisitions and were still a thorn in our side. They were a smaller company. They could have done that. We just couldn't have pulled that off. So I don't know if that got to some of what you were looking for, but it was definitely an incredible time, incredible life experience to have had.
Definitely what I was looking for. It's always interesting to see sort of how, just the additional context of like how this actually, like how this deal shaped up is always super interesting. We got a couple minutes left, so I'm going to leave that to Kenny. I know you got a question. Why don't you jump in here?
Sure. Thanks so much, Michelle. So it's a bit of a tactical question, but it's one that I'm really interested in sort of your perspective with your experience. So it's about customer interviews, and it's actually a couple of questions bundled together. So focusing on, let's say, mid-market and enterprise, and if you notice a contrast between the two within the context of the question, I'd be interested in that too. So imagine going in totally open-minded. You don't have a product idea. You've sort of minimized your bias and you've maximized your curiosity. What do you think is the minimum amount of time that's appropriate to spend in a day of the life interview with one of these people? And what do you see as sort of the minimum number of interviews you think before you would expect to see any sort of meaningful pattern? And then how does that contrast from maybe what you consider to be ideal?
Interesting. I did usually hour interviews. Like, half an hour didn't feel you know, long enough. And frankly, one of my objectives, by the way, was to make friends with them enough that they'd like talk to me again, because I had follow-up questions. So if I took that hour, I probably spent 20 minutes getting to know them and kind of bonding with them, and 40 minutes of it interviewing them. And some of these people who I interviewed, I went back to multiple times as I got threads that came out in later interviews, and I kind of went back to ask them questions. So that's usually what I did. I mean, there were a subset of people who I ended up deciding were visionaries, and like they were the signal. And so I probably talked to them, you know, two or three times over the course of that. And then there were people who I interviewed once and thought their data was interesting, but didn't think they told me enough that I needed to go back and spend more time with them. So I didn't spend the same amount of time with each person. So that was your first question. Sorry, guys, I have painters here. Your second question was?
Number of interviews.
Number of interviews. So I probably did 300 over the course of about 4 months. I would say for me, I saw patterns around the 50 to 75 mark. Like, you need enough. And by the way, I was interviewing HR and marketing and sales. So I, maybe if I was, had a narrower product idea, I would have needed less interviews. But I don't think you need a ton of interviews to find patterns. What I needed, because I told you guys, I iterated through three ideas. This was my third idea. I needed enough signal to like figure out which idea I should focus on. Like, you know, there were multiple product ideas in the first 50 interviews, but it took me more time to try to figure out which ones were most important. So that 300 kind of took me through three ideas. The other thing we did was we took all of our notes in Evernote, and like I built an Excel spreadsheet, and we would like cross-reference them, and we were looking for patterns. So we probably made it more data-oriented than some people would have. But I mean, you know, it netted out a category. So you know, I think it was effective. And I don't know the right number. That's a really a good question. I mean, I think like you have to make sure, I feel, if you're gonna do something for 10 years or 15 years, or like go raise money and take people's money and try to give them a return, you wanna, like you as the founder have to be pretty convicted that this thing's real. And for me, because I wasn't a marketing expert or a, you know, sales expert, I didn't come out of, you know, your world necessarily, Colin, I didn't have as much life experience to judge how good it was. So I just used data. So I think we ended up with the market, and obviously there's a category and, you know, we're a leader, but I think maybe I needed more data than a founder who came out of the space would have needed. So probably not the best answer. Sorry.
No, that was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Very helpful.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Perfect. Lavinia, I want to give you an opportunity. Anything, any questions you want to ask Michelle?
Hi, Michelle. Yes, please. It's a quick one again about interviewing customers. So during this process, especially doing 300, it's going to be really natural to form opinions and kind of have a personal bias. How do you personally make sure that you're checking that bias throughout the process so it isn't influencing the people you're interviewing and the whole process? Like, how do you make sure you keep that at bay to keep it separate from that kind of objective research?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key, you know, again, how well did I do? Time will tell. But for me, the key has always been neutral interview questions. Not so I, you know, to me, poor product management is I walk in and show you a UI and I say, what do you think about this UI? I've like completely led you down the garden path. So all of my interviews were very much the same 20 questions. By the way, during the course of interviewing, I added a few, like I started to uncover some interesting angles and I'd add a question, but I never went to my interview and said, do you guys need a journey orchestration product? I kind of went in and started with like, how many systems do you manage? And tell me what you do first thing in the morning. And like, what do you do after that? And so I tried to ask very open-ended questions and then basically just take a ton of notes and go back to them, as opposed to kind of leading them. And I will tell you, when we founded the company, my co-founder and I each put in like 30 grand later and hired one developer and built a prototype. And we did later go back at that point and say, hey, we have this idea. Will you, you know, take a look at it? And we got great feedback at that point. But all my early interviews were basically completely open-ended. And obviously it goes without saying, I used the same questions in every interview. So that I really, it was very structured. I had a Word doc that I used. I think I had like 19 questions when I started and 24 when I ended. and everyone asked the same questions. And then I, by the way, took notes if they brought up things that I didn't think about. You know, I would put that on the notes, and that's what ended up generating more questions. But I never deviated the process. I never walked in and said, hey, I heard from another client that you guys have a ton of systems that don't connect together. Is that true? I mean, that's like very, I'm going to get the answer I want out of that question. It was always like, you know, tell me about a day in the life. How many systems do you log into a day? Why do you do that? All as much open-ended as I could possibly be, and not leading them to my conclusion.
Yeah, that makes sense. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Lavinia. Thanks, Kenny. Michelle, I know we went a couple of minutes over, and so I apologize for that. But thank you so much for your time and coming on the show and spending extra time with us. This was 90 minutes just flew by.
I know. Such a pleasure. Well, Colin, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation. It's always a good chance to kind of reflect on your time and try to synthesize conclusions and share them with other people. So really appreciated the opportunity. Just enjoy the discussion. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. All right. Shout out to Predictable Revenues, Service LinkedIn Outbound, Service for sponsoring this video. As a founder and sales leader myself, I know most of the best practices in terms of like what I need to be doing on LinkedIn. But sometimes I just don't have the time. You know what the right things to do are, but it just comes down to a trade-off of where's my time better spent? And can I find somebody to click around on LinkedIn for me and book meetings, you know, and then I can focus on higher level activities. And so think about it. What's the best use of your time? If you're a founder, sales leader, and you have a team, you need some meetings, I'd encourage you to check it out. I'm using it myself. I'm obviously the founder, so eating our own dog food. But if you're curious, click the link below to learn more.